Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of August 14th, 2016. This is Jack Brissett-Mills. Conversation today with Arielle. Talked with her once before this year. But first, the verses I wrote for Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul for his week 20. This one I wrote 2 years ago, verse 20. I am blessed to find at last a beautiful, terrible truth. No matter how powerful I am, nor how wise I become, building my own castles without the world, I am dead. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse, 20a. I feel the truth now of my independence. How, if I actually separated, divorced myself from the world, I would be nothing. And building my own strong castles, I would simply die a miserable, lonely death. Yeah, this is a wonderful conversation and quite long, so I cut it into two parts. Part one today. Arielle, thank you so much for your life, your enthusiasm for life. Thank you for listening. Here you go. Thanks for talking with me. This is so nice.
Yes, absolutely.
That's quite a gift when you're fully present. Your job is being present for people, isn't it? It's really quite nice.
Yeah. It's changed a little bit lately because I got promoted, so I'm no longer directly on the phone, and instead I'm a manager and support in a support role for the advocate. But
okay.
A lot of that time still is spent being present with the advocate.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
a little switching gears there. Yeah,
I saw this lovely sentence. I guess it was in a movie. Listening is loving. And I thought of you, people like you, that's their job. This psychologists or caregivers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really powerful truth, and I think it takes so much more than just hearing. I know that in training at the hotline, they talk about the difference between hearing somebody and listening to somebody, and you know, hearing being kind of a passive, like a physiological process, and listening being an active, engaged, interpersonal process. Yeah.
I noticed that if I'm listening to an audiobook and I'm doing a text message or whatever else, I know that I miss the audiobook. I totally don't hear both at once. You really can't do both at once.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's really hard these days to not be doing more than more than one thing at a time. It takes takes almost more effort than the multitasking itself.
I've had this little training this year. I mean, it's been my job to listen, so I've really been reaching in to the other person with my eyes closed, trying to hear every bit of what they're saying. But it's really quite an effort, and you don't do it in normal life, apparently. People don't do that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's not the normal mode, for sure.
You know, I was talking to someone recently, and they were explaining how they have never seen a difference. I'm changing the subject now. This person said they never see a difference, or they never can imagine a difference between one person elected and another person elected. And their life is fine pretty much as it is. And they just don't see what all the fuss is about, And I said, aren't you actually speaking the white privilege argument? Aren't you actually saying that?
Yeah.
And they said, well, yes, of course I am. And they still then looked at me like, what have you got? You know, what could I tell them that would convince them to be different than that? And boy, I was at a loss. I can only say for myself what hurts me when I don't respect someone, or when I see that the people I belong with, my power structure, my white male power structure, is doing something. I feel guilty, and So then the argument was, well, why do you consider yourself part of them? That's just some social construct. There's no such thing as we in any sense. It's only just individuals. It was such an interesting argument. I could not figure out a way to reach in and say why. Yeah. Why should anybody care about anybody else? I don't know how to do that. How can you do that?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's such a profound, like, that's like the crux of the issue, because it seems like we can't fabricate or like necessarily, at least I'm not able to. I think there are probably wonderful philosophers out there who have some really compelling logical arguments, but it seems like, you know, connection is something that's hard to convince somebody of.
Yeah.
Like it's more felt, and it's more has to originate with some, I don't know, something more experiential than an argument. But I think that's such a, I love that you said that they're, you know, speaking the white privilege argument, because that's so on the nose, you know, able to, because the thing is that, you know, politicians come from the ruling class. Politicians serve the ruling class. They their job is to uphold white supremacy and to uphold, you know, the class structure and the capitalism that we are currently operating under. And so, of course, the people who they're built to serve are not going to have it feel any different, you know, because that's the whole, you know, that's the whole thing, is maintaining the status quo for those people. So it makes perfect sense when people don't feel it. Yeah.
Of course, personally, I can't say as a fact that if there were people of color who were also millionaires in Congress, would they be totally the same as other millionaires? And maybe we're only talking about a class difference rather than a racial difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think I know that there's a large contingent of like Maoist in Austin, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they view like a class as having primacy over all other aspects of identity. I don't completely buy into that, because I think that, I mean, I view gender as like profoundly influencing of every, you know, element of our lived experiences.
Yes,
but
yes.
I also think that there's a lot of weight to that class argument, because there are women who don't hold other women's self-interest at heart. You know, there are Republican women politicians who, again, uphold that. They uphold patriarchy, they uphold capitalism, and they stomp on other women. So, you know, I think it's also reductive to just reduce somebody to, like, one axis of their identity and say, your womanness inherently makes you a certain way. But,
Hey, do you do the same thing I do at, like, the Republican convention? I spend all my time looking at the women just to try to figure them out. They're the most interesting things on earth right now, just to look at Republican women and try to understand them. They're just so interesting.
Yeah. It is fascinating. I mean, it's totally fascinating, because, you know, you sometimes, I mean, it's hard to, like, find that balance of treating that person as somebody with agency, somebody capable of making their own decisions, making their own wretched, terrifying decisions.
Yes.
But also wondering, like, to what degree do you have internalized misogyny? To what degree are you, like, you know, completely buying into your own oppression? And so it's hard to find that way of, like, treating them as, like, adults capable of their own cognition, their own reasoning, but also wondering how much that is colored by being part of a system that was never meant for them to survive or thrive, you know? Really, really, really fascinating.
I mean, I don't think we can get I don't think we get any answers, but I love the questions. The one I had, I saw this great, it was a great movie from the 30s about Ziegfeld, Flo Ziegfeld. He was the fellow who made the biggest shows on Broadway, Ziegfeld Follies. And there was a movie made of him, in the 30s. Movie won Academy Awards for being greatest picture. Anyway, I watched it, and I saw these shows. And here, suddenly, a man in blackface came out to perform, and I never saw this before. And they show the audience enjoying it. And, of course, every person is a tuxedoed white person, or an evening-gowned white lady, and they're all enjoying this white guy in a black face, And I just, Barbara and I just were stunned watching and just saying, why is this happening? And is it impossible to tell you're a racist from the inside? Can you only be told you're a racist? Those people had no clue that there was anything wrong with what they were doing. Not a bit. But now today we look at it and go, my God, how could you do that? Oh, my yeah. God. It's so interesting. Just yeah. all those clueless people.
Yeah.
It's really,
or you got to wonder if it's not so much clue. Like, I think about this a lot, you know, the kind of deep philosophical questions about, for example, you know, from my world where they come up a lot is, you know, when I work at the hotline dealing with domestic violence and, you know, that question that is so profound to people is like, why are abusive people abusive? Like, do they just not know that they're harming me? Uh-huh. And I think that it's, there's another way to like sort of look at it.
Good.
Which is like, they know that the harm is being caused. But it's about their worldview, and in their worldview, that harm is justified because their humanity is more important to them than the other person's humanity. So it's not that they know that they're or don't know that they're causing suffering, or they don't know that the other person is profoundly oppressed and unhappy. But it's that in their worldview, that logic adds up because they dehumanize the other person, and so it's only logical from that point of view that like. Yeah, that person deserves to be stomped on. That person deserves for their humanity to be stripped away because they don't have it to begin with in that person's frame of mind. You know?
Does that make
it, I don't know, somehow that
is that impossible then to reason with them? Does that mean they're completely immune to reason?
I mean, I think in the vast majority of cases, at least, you know, looping back to like batterers, the vast majority of the time there's no interest in change because the change is so hard. And the change is not always rewarding, right away. And so I think that, at least in those cases, it's very... And a lot of times there's this profound, just desperate plea of like, well, can I have him call? Can you explain this to him? Can I hand him the phone so you can talk to him and explain this to him? You know, and it's like, no, I mean, I could say the words, but if there's no... interest in changing, it's not like they're going to have an aha moment while I'm explaining it to them, because it's not that they don't get it. It's not that they don't get that their behavior is abusive. It's that they don't care. They don't have a worldview where their humanity is important enough for their inconvenience, you know, to matter to them.
That's the very thing I was talking about with the person I talked with this week. I'm sitting there telling them how, for example, if I buy something for $100 and then I use it, and then I'm done with it and I want to sell it, there's a philosophy that says I should sell it for as much as I can possibly sell it for.
Mm-hmm.
But personally, I know I would be cheating somebody. So I want to even show them what I paid for it. I want to tell them that I used it. So $90 or $80 is the most I would ask.
Yeah,
and that's what I want to do. So the person I'm talking with says, "Man, I'm so happy. I'm not like that. I want to get as much. I want to get as much as I can from people. And why should I care? Why would you teach me to care like you do? That sounds like a horrible burden. And yet, from my side, I think my position is much more healthy, much more alive. I'm much happier. I think I'm much happier. But I can't convince anybody of that."
Yeah, totally. Well, and I think also it's like if we live in a world where, right, we tend to generalize our worldview and wonder why people don't share our worldview because it makes sense to us. And I think that, like, there's something comforting about living in a world where you think that people operate that way. If you say, well, I wouldn't try to rip somebody off, you may not go through the world hyper-vigilant that other people will rip you off, you know?
Right.
And I think that's a much more... peaceful and joyful. Well, that's the world I want to live in. If I treat people with assuming the best and assuming that you know, if I've got their back, they'll have my back. Gee, I would much I'd much rather go through the world that way than trying to, you know, nickel and dime people and assume that they're doing the same to me, because that's a total recipe for defensiveness. Exhausting.
I wonder if it has something to do with love. If you try to explain love, like a 10-year-old wants to know what love is, it's hard to really tell them. You'll just know when you when you have it, you'll know. You can't really explain it. I wonder if this is what we're talking about, this interest in the other, the empathy we have for others.
I think, you know, I've loved that you asked some really kind questions last time that it feels so great to be asked. And, you know, I think are really valuable about, like, how do we become this way? Like, how do we try to grow our communities in that way? How do we intentionally try to foster that stuff?
Yes.
You know, I'm not sure exactly, but I think it's really, really wonderful to think about, like, how can we model that behavior? How can we talk to kids, you know, in a way that's imbued with those values and stuff?
The example you show is the best way, I'm sure, but it has to also be somewhat public, because if you're simply a saint in a cave, no one will know you're a saint. So the saint has to go in. The saint has to go into town. And I don't know. It seems like we have to step into the public. To show people what you can do. Go ahead.
Oh no! Yeah, sorry, I got excited.
Yeah, go.
That's so interesting, because I was just talking. You know, I have this sort of conversation with some of my loved ones with some regularity about how in Austin, for example, in leftist, you know, progressive circles where people are doing various kinds of organizing, you know, it's often the loudest people who are doing the least, you know, the reason they're loud is because their motivation is, you know, needing recognition, which that's in and of itself a whole question of like, why are they that way? And maybe they deserve some sympathy for that. But it's really interesting, because we do want those things to be known and to be modeled. But, like, at the same time, it's almost there's an inverse relationship between how loud somebody proclaims their good deeds and how genuine and valuable those good deeds are for other people. Yeah. And I struggle with that. I mean, Facebook is just utterly, utterly exhausting to me, because, you know, I have at this point over 1,000 friends. You know, I was counting up my social circles the other day, kind of being like, huh, where do I know people from? Where are my friends from?
Yeah.
And I counted about 9 different circles of people who I associate with, and each one of those is their own little constellation of, you know, views and beliefs and values. And so I usually just find myself sort of cornered into silence by my own analysis of, like, you know, this contingent of family who's really, like, hold racist views, like, they'll be offended about it in this way. But then, like, my extreme leftist friends will think it's not leftist enough, and I finally just sort of corner myself into silence, because I'm like, oh my God, I don't have the time for any of that. And
there you are.
So, you know, the enriching conversations happen a lot of times in person, but at the same time, I'm sort of a consumer on Facebook, and that the main reason I'm there is because I have brilliant friends who post brilliant articles are part of that refining process for my thoughts. And so, I don't know, it's just interesting thinking about, like, what public image is, because, you know, I tend to find that the people who post the loudest proclamations are the most, in some ways, some of the most dangerous people I know, you know, in terms of their egos. And it's really hard, but I don't think that silence is good either. So I don't know where the line is.
On a practical level, I would tell you that the way I do it is I use Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all for different groups of people, and I would never have 1,000 anywhere, because that means I can't be myself. I must be quiet.
Right.
I must be quiet. So each one I've blocked, I blocked certain groups of people from each one, so that in this one I can be this way, and that one I can be that way.
It's so interesting, because at the same time, I also really honor and, like, admire, there are a couple people I know who constantly wage battle or constantly engage the process of calling people in and calling people out. And like, there's a couple people I know who keep all of their racist friends and family and keep all of their misogynist bro cousins and college buddies, and they constantly engage them. And I find that's like, could be a full-time job. I don't have the stamina for that, or the constitution. I'm not
amazing.
You know, but it's like those people are really, they've got something going too that I really admire.
I think it is constitutional. I get liver illness whenever I fight with people like that. I just get pains in my trunk, and I just can't do this.
Absolutely. And it's funny, because given that I have such a diversity of friends and so many of them, I think it's really fascinating that I don't get in more arguments, you know, that people don't comment more. And it's maybe because I'm not a very argumentative person in a lot of people's minds. And so that, you know I wouldn't bother to engage all the people I know. So I wonder if they just have some people who just roll their eyes at me. but won't ever say it and spare me the
I don't know. I feel you've got a lot of moral weight behind you. Whenever you say something, I would be so upset if you were mad at me. I would feel that there's something wrong with the world. So I think you have a lot of moral weight behind you, and you could use it in any way you want. You could use that in any way you want.
Yeah. I'm still learning how to wield those.
Yeah.
You know, I really pick my battles. Like, for example, there are some men in our, Waldorf community, dads who I'm friends with Facebook, who have posted stuff, and it just utterly disappointed me. It just makes me so sad. And it's funny because I realize, like, the Waldorf community, I grew up thinking, it was all I knew. So I grew up thinking that was the epitome of everything. And I've stepped outside of it long enough now to see that it's actually a profoundly white, profoundly upper class bubble.
Yep.
And there's a lot of flaws, and it's so insular. That insular self-righteousness is really exhausting and toxic in a lot of ways. And,
it is.
There's a lot of beauty in it, and there's a lot of beautiful people, but I would not choose that as my primary community now in my life.
No way.
And, so that's been difficult because there have been some, white, rich dads who, I've been friends with and I'm just like baffled because I still sometimes revert to thinking of Waldorf as a haven of, all that is good. And I realize actually they're occupying the same white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy that everybody is steeped in. And so there was one incident where I just, it ate, speaking of, tummy issues, it just ate at me for days, and I drafted up a whole long letter to him, and I was like, oh, this disappointed me, this made me sad, this makes me feel, disappointment in our values as a community, and I never ended up sending it because I just got so exhausted thinking, what did you say back, and what were the ruptures in that relationship? I just held it to myself, but...
I'm so sorry. I don't know if you noticed, I put something up maybe 2 months ago about if you're a white male and you're over 30 or 40, you have a tendency to get a big belly, and you have a tendency to become a racist. And that's just what you see. Who are the racists in our society? They're generally the older white male with big bellies. And so I said, well, okay, then we have to start when we're 20 or 30, starting to counteract that. So we look at ourselves in the mirror more often, and we try to hold our belly in, and we have friends from other cultures, and we travel, and we have young friends. You know, we do all these things to keep ourselves from doing what is stereotypical.
Yeah.
I mean, the old idea was, if you're a Japanese tourist, you should not have a camera around your neck. You know, when I was a young person, that was the Japanese tourist. So it's always nice not to be the stereotype. You know, if you're a white if you're a white guy over 50, it's so nice when you're not a racist. It'd be really nice if you could not be the stereotypical guy. The other thing about liberal is it tends toward aristocracy. If you are in a highly segregated liberal community and then you become affluent, you are going to be an aristocrat. You're not going to remember the pioneering spirit of the olden days. That's what's so weird about Waldorf schools. Always start out as a pioneering effort of hippies and granola eaters and no money and high levels of community. The community you're talking about in Austin right now is very much aristocracy because it's been around long enough. We need another Waldorf school to start here that has that pioneering every race, every culture feeling. It's really hard, really hard when it's only only the one example.
Absolutely. And I think that, there is that like paradox of success. Like, what are we, like, of course we want the community to grow, and of course we want to have funding for all the colored pencils that anybody could dream of, and of course we want new buildings, and but there's that paradox of growth, that growth happens within, again, it happens within capitalism, it happens within white supremacy. You can't divorce it from those things. And so it starts to mimic those those structures the more it tries to, adapt to them and flourish within them.
I mean, that's the devil in the details, I guess. The first Waldorf school was for the poor children of the factory, the cigarette factory children, you know. That was the beginning. And now it's become this upper class thing, at least in our country.
Yeah.
It's very sad, very sad, very sad.
Totally. And I think it's been wonderful reconnecting with all of my classmates, you know, because I think the hopeful side of it is seeing who they all grow, who we all, I won't distance myself from it, who we all grow into, you know.
Yeah.
And I know, I remember the messed up things that I, you know, I remember specific incidents of saying things that I didn't realize were messed up at the time, or, you know, a sort of social ineptitude about making new friends because I'd grown up in such an insular community where I never had to make new friends. And, you know, I see that growth within myself, and I see it mirrored in the people around me too. So there's hope beyond it, but I think there is stagnation when you don't, you know, when you're not in college, when you're not, you know, exercising those brains all the time. So
a while ago, when you mentioned people who are loud, needing attention. My friend actually actually calls that attention deficit disorder, that you never had enough attention given to you as a child, and you end up having attention deficit. And he was really saying it was very similar to actual attention deficit disorder. That, of course, I don't know the psychological background of that, and I can only postulate. But someone who needs attention is going to be disordered. They're going to be disordered as an adult.
Yeah. It's interesting because this makes me think of this, like, little ideas just sprout and blossom off of everything that you say, and I want to say them all.
Good.
I guess that's part of the filtering and the listening is figuring out which ones are important. But yesterday I had the honor of getting to listen to a talk by a Chilean anarchist who's doing some really interesting organizing in Chile, and, you know, he brought up we talk a lot about the nitty-gritty, like, foibles of organizing communities, and you know, one of the things he brought up that's sort of an Achilles heel of organizing in Austin and in a lot of cities in the U.S. is this individualism, which I know is sort of an old tired trope. And there's, you know, tropes about, you know, individualist U.S. versus collectivist other cultures. And those are sometimes imperfect ideas, but I think they have a lot to offer. You know, he was talking about how in organizing communities in the U.S., like, people's priorities and individual feelings are so elevated above the group goals that makes it really hard to, like, kick out shitty dudes when they do shitty dude things. Because, you know, they have so many arguments at their fingertips about their needs about being put above the groups. And somebody brought up this fascinating point about why, like, consensus is a really popular mode of operating in organizing collectives in Austin and other, you know, cities, because it gives the individual the weight to block something that all 20 other people in the group want.
Yes.
You know, and so the reason that started popping up in what you were saying for me is wondering, like, if it's not just people who don't receive the attention they need, but the value that we put on that attention. You know, like, kids are raised in a culture of thinking, you know, you're so special, you're so individual, you're so unique, you're going to do great things. And I know a lot of my peers grew up in that, a lot of my white affluent peers, including, you know, myself, like, grew up feeling like we were so special. And there's this devastating confrontation with reality when you go, you know what, I am one of many human beings on this planet, and I will not necessarily go down in the history books, and I won't necessarily be the boss of everything I do. And so part of me wonders if it's not just that people don't get the attention that they need, but that attention is, like, prioritized in a way that, like, would make not getting it feel so much crappier. You know?
Right there, though, I want to take that right there, because I thought of that a lot. Mm-hmm. Should you, the first day you meet a baby, start telling them how rotten the world is and how you're not special, or should you give them this false picture? There's, like, Santa Claus, there's Christ, there's God, there's whatever, there's Abraham, there's everything makes sense, and then later let them find out that that's all a joke too. Should you tell them right away the world's a horrible place, or should you let them live in a false perfect world and then be devastated by the result when they're in their 20s, I almost think that's better. I almost think it's much better to give them the false childhood picture of how everything is great. Boy, I don't know. I've never had children, so I have no idea.
Yeah. I mean, I had the privilege of being shielded from a lot of that, and I feel like it gave me space to be tender for a lot longer. But I want to offer, like, one complicating factor to that. And again, I don't think this addresses your actual question which is better in an ideal scenario, which I don't know, but I think it's interesting because the choice, the ability to choose between how children are raised is, like, such a white insular thing. Because,
it is.
There's a lot of really powerful articles that circulate on social media about, like, how to teach, like, young white kids about racism because young brown and black kids, like, they cannot be shielded from it. Like, moms now, after, like, Tamir Rice was killed, like, murdered by police, like, they have to worry, like, my kid can't play with a BB gun in the street because he could get shot in cold blood. And so it's just interesting. It doesn't answer the question, but I think it
For the people who have the choice of shielding their child. Yeah, you're right. Most of the world has no choice about that whatsoever.
Yeah, I could go on with that, but half an hour is long enough for a podcast. I'll put this up, part two, next week. Thank you so much. If you have any comments, drop me a line at jackmills@mac.com or see my website, reasoningwithanoptimist.net. This is Jack Brissett Mills. Bye-bye.